week of June 14th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 8, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In New York, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
Now, before we get started, I just want to point out, I am traveling. We're recording using different equipment than we usually use. I'm not in the studio, so the audio quality may sound a little different from what you've heard in previous episodes. But we still have a lot to talk about tonight, starting with a little news about Karen, actually. How you doing? I hear you had a tough week, to say the least.
The economy caught up with me. You know, you kind of watch all your friends lose their jobs or their companies go under, and you just kind of assume it's not going to happen to you until it does. I work at a company that does official celebrity websites, and I managed about 25 websites. And we're the typical startup. We went from, funding to funding, and in between bursts of funding, we crossed our fingers and just reached that point where the funding wasn't going to come in a timely manner in which to pay everybody. So we're not officially going under per se. We're restructuring, I suppose, is a good way of putting it. But yeah, I don't know what's going to happen.
So now, what's the name of the company?
It's called Booeep.com.
How do you
B-O-O-E-E-P. It was the absolute worst company name to have to give out because everyone always said, what?
B-O-O-E-E-P. Okay, so two O's, Whoop. Two E's. Yep. And so you were a web producer for celebrity websites.
Right.
And on a daily basis, you helped build these websites and maintain these websites and write the copy for these websites. Is that
and
accurate?
Go to the studios and get the assets and, talk to the clients and find out what they wanted to do and give them advice. And I managed social media and just kind of everything for their online presence. And, it was a great idea for a company. I still think it's a great idea for a company.
And the sites will stay up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll stay up. I think my boss is probably going to pay me a retainer to continue managing them. But, and maybe at some point we'll get funding again. I can't imagine that we're just going to get rid of the websites.
But at that point, you might have another job.
I might. The good thing about working at a startup is that you get a lot of hands-on experience doing everything. So, it's certainly helped my resume. I've gone from a writer to a web producer. So, can't begrudge anybody that.
Well, working at a startup is always a crapshoot in the best of times. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry to hear that things didn't go as well as you had thought, but that you actually gained some valuable experience.
Yep, and I met a lot of really interesting people.
Well, certainly
we'll see.
Yeah, we'll continue to keep tabs on where you land and what you're up to. And you very well, as you said, may land back at Booeep.
Yeah.
It's a hard name to pronounce.
That's what I told the boss. Not quite that nice, but my feelings were known. Why don't you share why you're in New York?
I'm in New York for a high school reunion, and I don't know whether I should say what year, 20-year high school reunion. Yeah.
Is everybody fat?
Well, on the grounds that I could incriminate myself, I probably shouldn't say anything. I would say the women got smaller, the men got bigger, and they have less hair now.
The women got smaller?
Well, thinner, I guess.
Well, good for them.
Yeah, all the women looked great. So
I don't think I wouldn't go to my high school reunion.
It was a lot of fun. It really was. It was more fun than high school.
Almost anything was more fun than high school.
Well, I grant you that. It's funny. I think we tend to nostalgize that period of our lives when we go back to these types of events like reunions. And yet,
it's horrible.
The events that happened during high school help shape us for the rest of our lives, and we wind up dealing with some of the psychological repercussions from events that happened during that time period for the rest of our lives.
I learned how to play hooky and how to do drugs.
That might be too much information.
Very right beneficial there. Things for my current life.
You do work in Hollywood. Well, with all this newfound free time that you have, did you get to see The Hangover this weekend?
That would be no.
Well, a lot of people did get to see The Hangover this weekend. In its second week, it came in first place at the box office over the weekend, the North American box office, that is. It made $33.4 million in 3,300 screens.
Good for them.
It dropped only 25.7%, and its total gross to date is $105.3 million. And so it actually beat up the Pixar animated film, which came in first last week and the week before that.
Beat him up?
It didn't beat him up too bad because Up made... Oh, I get it. Beat him up. Yeah. I still may be hungover from my high school reunion, actually.
Oh, yeah, I do seem a little out of it. I read that the Eddie Murphy movie bombed.
The Eddie Murphy movie did bomb. Imagine That opened in sixth place, $5.7 million on just over 3,000 screens.
When are people going to stop giving Eddie Murphy movies to headline? Hello, he's over.
I don't know. You know, what's interesting is I was flying on Virgin America to New York over...
Sponsor us. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I shouldn't have mentioned the airline. although that airline, you have to pay for everything.
That's the way it is with all airlines now.
I know, but that airline in particular, they don't give you soda, peanuts, nothing. They give
None
you
of them
seat.
Do anymore.
Oh, really? I didn't.
Yeah, Frontier maybe.
I keep flying international where they at least feed you.
Oh, excuse me.
Well, okay.
I'm flying American to New York next weekend, so I'll let you know what they have.
So I'm sitting there on the plane flipping through all these channels that they give you on Virgin America. I said the name again. And
sponsor us, yeah.
And I came across The Nutty Professor, and I'm watching this thing, and I'm thinking, whatever happened to Eddie Murphy? This movie did huge numbers. It earned a ton of money, and he's actually pretty good in it. I mean, he's playing 9 different characters, 10 different characters. I don't even know how many characters he played in that film. And it was fairly funny. I mean,
well,
it wasn't.
What happened? Comedy changed. Judd Apatow and company, the Saturday Night Live, Andy Samberg, Dick in a Box, that all became what's funny and sort of more chaste, family-oriented humor that Eddie Murphy does and I guess arguably Mike Myers sort of kind of did. That era's done.
Well, it appears that Imagine That might be done because it came in sixth place in its opening weekend. Another movie that opened this weekend was The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. That's a remake of the 1974 film. But
I think it was remade twice. It was made in the 1950s, and then it was remade in the 1970s as a TV movie, which, by the way, is on tonight, and then this time around.
It's a Tony Scott thriller. So Tony Scott directed it. Denzel Washington stars as a subway employee who tries to help hostages on a subway train get released. And, of course, the hostage taker is John Travolta.
Again, these are two people that, like Eddie Murphy, their time has come and gone. They're over. They're not movie
Denzel
stars.
Denzel Washington?
Yeah, I think he's done.
Oh, I strongly disagree. I think he's actually one of America's best actors.
Well, that's not what I'm saying, but he's not a movie star anymore.
I don't know. Well, his film made $25 million in its opening weekend. It didn't win the weekend.
But it didn't win the weekend.
Well, we'll see.
There was a time when a Denzel Washington, John Travolta movie, an action thriller, would have been a no-brainer. It would have won the weekend hands down. And now that it's coming in third, with these two aging actors,
Who would you have cast in this movie? If not Denzel Washington.
First of all, I would never have done this movie. I mean, I would never have done a movie that's been remade twice. I would have cast... Oh, that's a tough question. Honestly, I would have considered Ashton Kutcher for the Denzel Washington part.
That's already a movie I don't want to see.
Psycho would have been like Shia LaBeouf.
Oh, my goodness. So
that
what we're saying is...
That would have won a weekend.
Possibly. I guess what you're saying is, who is Al Pacino... Who is the Al Pacino of our age? of our generation?
That's a good question.
Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck?
Just as that is somebody who could have been cast as, say, the Denzel Washington character.
If he hadn't already completely ruined his reputation and kind of become a douchebag in the process, then I would agree with that.
Okay.
You know who would have been really interesting in a role like that? Would have been like Keanu Reeves.
Didn't he do that film already? Wasn't it called Speed?
That's a good point. Maybe that's why I'm thinking of him. You know, it would have been like really interesting. It's like a Jon Favreau, like put in like a character actor for one and then a major movie star for the other.
Well, at this point, the movie's made. It opened in third place, $25 million. Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian came in fourth place, $9.6 million. It's already made $143.4 million. Land of the Lost continued to suck wind, unfortunately, at $9.1
million. Unfortunately? Why do you say unfortunately? Did
you know, you want to see
the
industry do well. You want to see people make money.
I don't. I think Will Ferrell's got enough money.
The studio, though, that backed it, you'd hope that they would have made a good movie and people would go see it.
Well, if they'd made a good movie, people would have gone to go see it.
Well, enough people went to see it that it's made $34.9 million so far, but that's nowhere near the $100 million budget.
No, and if it was a good movie, then it would have, and if Will Ferrell hadn't been kind of overselling his welcome, it easily would have made $100 million by now. We're tired of Will Ferrell.
Oh my God, it dropped 51% in its
second
week.
Yeah,
that's bad. That's bad. Up only dropped 30%, which isn't so bad. And The Hangover only dropped 25.7. So,
see, it's movies like that that I want to see do well.
Well, a movie that everybody is certainly talking about and everybody hopes does well is James Cameron's Avatar. Of course, this is the 3D film that he has been making for at least 3 years, and he shot it in 3D.
Sam Worthington from Terminator.
Yes, Sam Worthington, the hot new actor. Yeah. Could have been a good choice for Pelham 1-2-3, but he was too
busy.
Yes,
he would have.
Avatar.
See? Now you understand what I'm saying. Relevant.
Well, there was an article in Variety called James Cameron's Game Changer? And it detailed how James Cameron has turned to Ubisoft Digital Arts, which is a video game manufacturer or publisher, to make the video game for Avatar, and it's so good that he's actually going to use some of the computer-generated animation and graphics in the film itself. So it's an example of a film influencing a video game, influencing the film that it's based on. Variety says here, Fox has scheduled a December release of his 3D film Avatar, and the filmmaker has pushed game publisher Ubisoft to create the video game industry's first stereoscopic title. How they're going to make that video game 3D, I'm not quite sure. They go on to say, what's more, Cameron
was so...
Can we
just talk for a second about how cool the word Ubisoft is?
Ubisoft?
Ubisoft. Sounds like a special brand of toilet paper. Go on.
A special brand of toilet paper. Well, I can tell you, working in the area that I do on a daily basis, which is motion picture exhibition and motion picture distribution, that community, the movie theater community, is really hoping that this film Avatar does well, because they have been purchasing 3D systems in preparation for this for about a year now. So they've been gearing up for Avatar at least 12 to 18 months. So this
are changing what they have specifically for this movie?
Well, they're changing specifically for 3D movies. You have to have digital projection, so you got to not necessarily throw out your 35mm equipment, but at least put it to the side or run it side by side with digital equipment. You have to have a digital cinema server, a digital projector, and a 3D cinema system. And those things cost a lot of money. That runs about $110,000 per screen on average. So think about a 10-plex, you're well over $1 million. You're at $1.1 million.
And are studios helping the theaters pay for this?
Oh, yes, they are. There's actually something called a virtual print fee, and the mathematics and the economics behind that get somewhat complicated, but they will actually pay if a theater upgrades and they show studio films. Each studio has individual deals with different theater chains to pay back the cost of the equipment over a 7 to 10 year period.
Okay, that sounds fair, right?
It's a very complicated relationship, and every studio has a different deal. So it's not just one deal to cover all the studios. And then what happens when you decide to show a film using that digital cinema equipment that isn't a part of the VPF agreement? Well, Sony or Paramount or Fox doesn't want to pay for that, so then you have to account for it. It's an accounting nightmare. It's a negotiation nightmare. The whole thing has been going on for 10 years, and every year seems to be the year of digital cinema. But what everybody has been hoping will push this over the edge and really thrust digital cinema into theaters is James Cameron's Avatar, because it is really shot in 3D for 3D. So it's meant to be projected in 3D. And if it does big numbers, watch how quickly people start converting their theaters.
So I can't imagine a more perfect movie to have that responsibility.
Well, and James can't. I mean, there's a lot riding on it.
But he pretty much can do no wrong in terms of this world of movie making.
That's true. And he's always pushed the envelope with each film that he's done like this, where he's pushing the technology a little further. He did it with Titanic. He did it with Terminator. He did it with Aliens. So we'll see what happens when this film is released. I know that he was at the Produced By conference over the weekend, and if you want, there's an interesting article on Ann Thompson's blog about that. And the Produced By conference was put on by Galen Hurd over at the Sony Pictures lot. And it was basically groups of producers and filmmakers getting together with people who paid to be at the conference, most of them in the industry themselves or industry wannabes, talking to them, whether it was, I don't think it was one-on-one, but it was in panel discussions and keynote speeches, talking about the industry, where the industry is today, and what's going on in filmmaking.
So you were on the Sony lot, you didn't come over and have lunch with me?
I didn't go. It was over last weekend.
Oh.
And I...
Well, okay then.
And, well, not only did I not go, but the press that did go was not invited to James Cameron's presentation.
I don't understand. Why? Was it not good enough to show people yet?
He may have been showing pieces of the film. He may have been showing pieces of Avatar. And he did.
Who was there to see it, if not for press?
The people paying for the conference.
Oh.
So I thought that was interesting. The press was invited to everything that happened at Produced By, except that one, whether it was a speech or seminar, I'm not quite sure, but they certainly weren't invited to that. Another thing that made news this week that theater owners will be happy about, I'm just going to skip ahead here to the story that we have on, also from Variety, DVD fans wait a little longer. For all theatrical titles released on or announced for DVD since January, the average window is 144 days, according to RenTrak Research. That compares with 125 days for the same frame last year and 133 for full year 2008. So on average, it looks like people are waiting 2 weeks longer.
You know, I always wondered how it was decided when a movie left theaters and came out on DVD. Is there some kind of an equation for that, or is it just... Oh, well, it's been 129 days. It's time to release it. Or do they say, oh, well, Easter's coming out. Let's release it then.
I know that theater owners and theater chains have really pushed hard, and NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, have really pushed hard to extend the window. Because it used to be, if you didn't see the film in theaters, you had to wait 6 months to a year for the video to come out.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
And audiences now feel, why bother going to the theater to see Star Wars if I can wait for the video?
And it's out in 2 weeks.
And it's out in 3 months, 4 months. The window shrunk to about 4 months, 7 days at one point. Mm-hmm. And now it's, of course, up beyond that. And I know NATO is very happy about it. I think this story, though, is a little sketchy because it never actually says who the sources of any of the quotes that appear in the stories are. It always just says studio sources or NATO spokesperson.
That's always a little sketchy.
But the release dates are obviously static, so you know when the film was released theatrically, and you know when the film was released on home video, so that part is a given.
Yeah,
They
but
write.
also, this, if you really look at it, what's the point of this story? So a little longer, so it's 2 weeks. This seems to me like,
Two
especially
weeks is a
since
big
no
thing,
one
but
will.
it makes total sense though, because when you look at the films that were playing, Paul Blart Mo Mall Cop, which you
Yeah.
expected 2 weeks tops, it played for over a month. So why would you put that on video 3 months after it's taken out of the theater? Slumdog Millionaire, same thing. Released in, I think, November or December, and it played well into March, April.
Right. I mean, you don't want to screw the theater owners for sure. You also don't want to screw, Netflix and Blockbuster, which I understand are becoming more powerful in terms of this. Their voice is larger in terms of this kind of choice.
And they
Interesting.
say here, just like I said, one widely held belief is that a number of studios simply waited for films to hit the street around Easter, which this year fell on April 12th, 3 weeks later than in 2008, when the holiday was on March 23rd. Another explanation is that certain films were granted longer theatrical berths because demand was high to see them on the big screen. Warner's June 9th release of Gran Torino, with its 179-day window, was a surprise box office hit, grossing $148 million in the U.S. And in what is, fairly typical of this story, they don't credit a specific executive with this next quote, but they say one studio executive argued that, quote, "It's not so much tied to the 3D of it all as it is how long of legs any given film has at the box office, whether it's in 2D or 3D. We give a film every opportunity to extend its life in theaters if there's still a demand for it before we choose a DVD street date." So that's the answer.
Well, but see, what I'm wondering is because, as you pointed out, everybody's speaking anonymously. I'm wondering if there was some other point to have given this article to Variety.
Well, the Cinema Summit starts this week in Brussels, which is a gathering of European theater owners. And then in another week, Cinema Expo starts in Amsterdam, which is a gathering of European theater owners and the studios, where the studios bring all of their summer films and show them to theater owners. So Rentrak is releasing this report. Variety obviously had to comment on it. They couldn't just not comment on it because it's an important topic that a lot of theater owners care about, and it's
Well, I
always.
don't disagree with that, but I'm just wondering why everyone's talking off the record. That's what interests me.
I don't know whether they were actually talking off the record or it was just, and I hate to say this, lazy reporting.
Oh, well, that's interesting to think about that. Who wrote this article?
I don't know, and it's probably somebody either I know or that's
It's
now going to be
totally
pissed
probably
at me.
somebody we know. Let's not say who it was.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You know what? I don't think it was lazy. I don't think it was lazy reporting. Moving on. Talking
Moving
about
on.
writers we know,
How about moving
Dan
on to,
Hoffman
we just
talks about
talked about
Hollywood.
Slumdog Millionaire, and did you hear about Danny Boyle's New Deal?
No, but I think you're about to tell me about it.
Yes, why don't I tell you about it? That's
Tell
kind of
me
what we
about it.
do
I
on
know
this
he
show.
got a deal with Fox Searchlight. I don't know any details beyond that.
Well, when Slumdog was released, Fox Searchlight picked it up from Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers, of course, produced it and paid to produce it and release it in the United States, but they put it into turnaround, so to speak. Although I guess you don't put a film that's been produced into turnaround, you basically just drop it. And that's what they did. They said, "We're not going to release it. Best of luck to you. We will cut a deal with some other studio who wants to pick it up." And Fox Searchlight picked it up and did very well with it, obviously. It's made $114 million. It's one of the most successful independent films of all time. And so Danny Boyle, the director of that film, signed a 3-year deal both with Fox Searchlight here in the United States and Pathé out of France. Variety reports, under the terms of the deal, Searchlight and Pathé will co-finance and co-produce Boyle's projects. Searchlight will distribute in the U.S. and a number of foreign territories not handled by Pathé. Pathé will distribute in territories including the U.K., France, Ireland, and Switzerland. So good for him.
Good for Danny Boyle. It's nice to see him do well. He seems like a nice guy.
I think he really seemed frustrated back in August when Warner Brothers ditched him and he was bringing his film around trying to find someone who would pick it up. And there was a lot of interest in it, but there was a point where it was going to go straight to DVD.
Oh yeah, I know. I know. And Fox Searchlight, they look like complete geniuses right now. Not that I'm not that I don't think they are geniuses, because I really think they are.
Of course, Fox Searchlight was, at the time, and for many years, run by Peter Rice, who is now one of the heads of Fox. He's the head of the Fox Network. Now, earlier in the show, you mentioned that you didn't think Pelham 123, the taking of Pelham 123, should be remade because it was a remake that had already been done a couple of times. Well, what about a remake that's only been done once before? The original has only been done, and now you're doing a remake. Let's say this movie was, off the top of my head, Conan the Barbarian.
Oh, you're talking Conan the Barbarian. Yeah,
I
don't see any reason to redo this movie. I remember seeing this movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and to me, he is Conan the Barbarian. There's no need to redo this movie. Just go back and watch this movie, or maybe re-release this movie. It still holds up.
Yeah, actually, but you know what?
I watched it with the commentary on. It's some of the funniest commentary I have ever listened to. I highly recommend it.
Well, there's an argument that could be made that Leonard Nimoy is the only Spock that ever should have graced the screen. And yet, J.J. Abrams did a very good job in casting that role for his reboot of the Star Trek franchise this summer.
You know, I don't disagree with what you're saying necessarily. I think there's a difference, though, between doing... To me, the Star Trek movie was essentially a TV show, and they turned it into a movie, despite the fact that they had done Star Trek movies. This, to me, was different. It was taking a television franchise, which had, granted, you know, moved on into to movies, most of which weren't very good, and rebooting it as a film franchise. I don't think you take... you don't take a movie that, I mean, I don't know how Conan the Barbarian did in the 80s or whatever, 82, when it was made, but I mean, Arnold
It did very well, actually. They made,
it's
like...
It's an iconic role for him.
Yes.
You don't need to redo it. It seems just, it seems like a lot of, a waste of time and money and assets. I don't, but you know, they're redoing Clash of the Titans, too.
Well, that I could see. That's a classic story. That's all mythological stories, so I could definitely see redoing that. Although the Harryhausen special effects...
By the way, you know who they're redoing it with, right?
I have no idea.
Sam Worthington.
So he should have been in the taking of Pelham 123.
He totally should have.
Well, they got Marcus Nispel to direct the remake of Conan, a job he says he has dreamed about since his childhood. And he's kind of a veteran of remakes. He directed the remake of The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the remake of Friday the 13th. So both of those films did well at the box office, and
so
now he's on his third
actually
remake.
Actually, it makes sense that he would do Conan. He's pretty good for Conan, isn't he?
Yes. He might have a... I think he was a music video director before that, a commercial music video director.
I think you're right.
A film like Conan, also based on a television show that probably shouldn't have been made based on its trailer, is G.I. Joe. And
I don't get this. Why are we making movies based off of toys? Oh, I'm sorry, Transformers, but still.
Actually, yes, Transformers were a toy. G.I. Joe was a toy. They were then transferred to television through animated series, and both successfully, at least, one successfully, turned into a live-action film, and now G.I. Joe was produced and will be released later this year. But there seems to be, according to Ann Thompson, a wee bit of a fracas here.
I love that word.
It's her word,
not
mine.
Tell us what happened.
She says here, fact, the internet tends to pile on to dramatic negative stories, whether or not they are true. That is the case with the rumor about Paramount taking director Stephen Sommers off summer movie G.I. Joe, The Rise of the Cobra. Fact, Angry Films' Don Murphy is one of the producers on the Transformers franchise, along with Lorenzo de Bonaventura, who is producing G.I. Joe. The two are not tight. And then she crosses out here, Murphy posted. And now she says a report was posted on donmurphy.net that Sommers was taken off the troubled movie. And then she writes, update, Murphy saw the post Thursday morning at 8:30 a.m., he writes in an email. And then she quotes Murphy as writing, I removed it, then 5,900 sites with no ethics referred to it as accurate based on nothing. Fact, Sommers is a hack director. He happened to direct one movie, The Mummy, which was such a huge hit that studio execs believed he was a commercial director who could handle visual effects. Fact, the best thing in things in The Mummy were supplied in great part by visual effects house ILM. Also on that film, Universal execs and producers Sean Daniel and Jim Jacks kept Summers in line. After he had a monster hit, he was harder to control. Fact: Van Helsing is one of the worst movies ever made. Fact.
No question. That is a fact.
Yes. Fact: G.I. Joe is tracking well and could be marketed into a hit. You never know. So she's kind of covering her tracks here, which I don't blame her.
Yeah,
fact.
Well, it's tracking well because people have heard of the property.
Yes.
Go on.
She says, fact, where there's smoke, there's fire. And then she writes, G.I. Joe's trailer is not encouraging. Which is very true. When they showed this trailer at Show West, everybody in the audience just kind of let out a big groan. It does not look good at all.
Oh, you know what? I've seen this trailer.
They actually showed extended clips.
It's so bad that you giggle.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
It looks pretty horrible. But who knows? It could be great. I mean, look at some of the trailers like Sin City, as we talked about last week, looked great in the trailer and was horrible as a movie. So maybe this is one of those trailers that is horrible as a trailer and is a wonderful movie. Highly unlikely.
That doesn't really happen anymore. And believe me, a trailer house that knew what they were doing did this one. I don't know which one it was, but I think we should look it up. I mean, probably somebody really good did this, and their job was to make it, you know, look better than it was, and not the opposite. I'm putting my vote in for this being a sucky movie.
I would concur. I remember watching G.I. Joe as an elementary school student, but it was a animated cartoon on television. And when I grew up, I didn't have cable television. Not because it wasn't invented, just because my parents didn't.
No, we didn't have it either.
Well, now you and I would be in a lot of trouble. Because this past weekend in the United States, the television, I don't know, the FCC.
Analog broadcast TV made its change over to digital.
Correct. And so now.
And I had to set up my converter because I actually have, in my bedroom, I have a television that had rabbit ears and picked up the analog broadcast signals.
You don't have a...
No, we do, but that's in the living room.
You don't
our
have
main TV.
Okay.
Yeah, so I had to get... I got a coupon like 6 months ago, and I went and I got my converter, and it sat on the floor of my room for months and months until I thought, oh no, June 12th is coming up. I better figure out how to do this. So I called up a boy. I said, Mike, come help me.
It's not that hard.
But it is for me, okay? I'm a girl. I have like an RF modulator that's plugged in so that I could use my DVD player. And so I had to figure out how to work that in and then how to work the TV. And then, you know, Mike got it all plugged in for me and I put it on like NBC and it's got like 4.1 and 4.2. And I just want to watch, you know, a Today Show. But it's there and it works and I get all kinds of channels now. It's really cool.
Well, this shift to digital transmission rather than analog has been going on for at least two decades. In 1996, Congress finally set a date and they said the switch would be February 17th, 2009.
Yep.
And February 17th rolls around and they decided, well, maybe not enough people knew about it despite the fact that they spent millions and millions of dollars to get the word out and that it was on the evening news every night. But really, the problem was the government ran out of coupons.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, that was the problem. And that was going to screw up everything.
The government was giving out coupons to subsidize the cost of these converter boxes. And what these
By the way, the coupons were like really cool. They weren't just those little paper things that you get in your newspaper. I mean, these were like little credit cards.
Yes, well, there was a reason for that. And that there was a fraud protection on them.
Oh.
And
I kind of wanted to keep my coupon. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a big deal when they handed these out, and they had to wait for all of them to expire so they could issue new ones because there was no more money in the budget to give out these coupons so people could subsidize their converter boxes. And what these boxes do is converts the digital television signal into an analog one so that the analog television sets that do not have tuners in them can receive the signal. And for people like myself who now have digital cable, I don't really need a set-top box or a converter because I just do it through my TiVo. And I think what they were predicting is that there were only going to be 3 million people that didn't make the switch. Really, what this highlighted was the huge divide in economic, the huge economic divide that exists in the United States between the people who can go out and afford televisions and those who can't.
To make it equal.
That's right.
I mean, I probably spent $9 on this.
Anyway, everybody predicted this to be a huge doomsday in the United States, that everybody's television was going to go dark.
They pushed back sweeps as well. Sweeps was actually in March this year instead of February.
That's right. They pushed back sweeps, you just said it, to March instead of February. And then in the end, they didn't do it in February. Go figure.
Yeah, I know. So we were all stuck in reruns in February for no reason.
And here's a little secret. If, at least in Los Angeles and several metropolitan areas, if you get the digital over-the-air signal of a high-def channel, it's actually being broadcast at 18 megabits per second. You can get incredibly clear pictures over the air in high-def. If you get the high-def signal the way I do, via cable or DirecTV or one of the satellite companies, it's broadcast between 4 and 6 megabits per second. If you're lucky, it's 6 megabits per second. So you get a better signal over the air on the free stations, the basic stations like CBS, ABC,
I know, I
NBC.
See the difference in mine.
Yeah, it's definitely, because it's either on or it's off. There's no in-between. There's no static.
There's no, quote-unquote noise. It's like, it's either working or it's not.
Well, that might have been the biggest techie TV story of the week, but by far the biggest TV celebrity story of the week had
to be... is my gay crush, Adam Lambert.
Yes. When I saw this, I just kind of hung my head knowing that we would have to talk about American Idol once more.
Whereas I clapped with glee and said, I have to buy Rolling Stone this week.
That's right. Rolling Stone magazine published a story. The headline
Adam
was...
Adam Lambert finally came out and said he was gay.
The liberation of Adam Lambert is the headline.
Well, and he was asked why he didn't come out before, and I thought that his reason was actually a good one, that he was, he said he was always out amongst the people on American Idol, but that he didn't want it to overshadow the fact that he just wanted to be a singer and a performer. And I thought that made a lot of sense. That was extremely savvy, because he's right. If he had come out while he was still performing, he would have been the gay guy. Whereas this way, he wasn't. We were focusing more on him as a performer. I mean, I think we all knew he was gay, but I like that it wasn't... I mean, he was on the cover of Entertainment Weekly, and there was a lot of speculation that he was gay, but, it didn't have to be, like when Ellen DeGeneres outed herself. But right as he... After he and Chris Allen stopped making their publicity rounds for American Idol... Rolling Stone comes out and he's relevant again. I mean, he's playing the news cycles to his advantage. He's really smart.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. Ann Powers in the LA Times wrote a fantastic piece that kind of summed up what I felt about the whole thing, which was, why the hell should we even care about who he's sleeping with? And what she writes here is really geared toward the music industry, but I kind of think it at least for myself and many people in this industry, the entertainment industry, kind of sums up the feeling about sexuality and why we have to care whether somebody's gay or not, or why we shouldn't care. Powers writes here, "By making his calm, cool, and collected stand in this particular magazine, Lambert indicates where he's going next as an artist and a celebrity, striking a hot pose in a space more accustomed to the likes of the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Kid Rock. The singer claims a spot for himself as an openly gay man within mainstream rock and roll, which has always tempered gender bending with heterosexual machismo." And she goes on to talk about how certain acts like the Red Hot Chili Peppers are extremely guy-oriented and male-oriented and somewhat macho, whereas David Bowie with Ziggy Stardust and his early work, you didn't know whether he was a man or a woman, and that's what she's referring to by gender bending.
Well, and yet at the same time, David Bowie was arguably pretty sexy, and I think what's interesting about this is that David Archuleta, who was the runner-up from American Idol last year. People also suspected that he was probably gay, but nobody really cared. And I think part of it, the reason why it wasn't such a big deal was because he was a minor, so it's kind of, you know, there's that ick factor. But also he doesn't have the sexuality that Adam Lambert has. And Adam Lambert was interviewed on 2020 last night, and the reporter, the journalist asked him, you know, commented on the fact that he's got a lot of women who have major crushes on him, you know, myself included. And I think it's just because he has this sexuality, and whether it's because he's gay or not gay, it almost doesn't matter.
Well,
he's on the cover of Rolling Stone because he is sexy.
Well, and Ann Powers talks specifically to that in her article by mentioning some of the people who are kind of androgynous, if you will. And I'm trying to find one here. Beck, classic example.
See, I don't consider Beck androgynous.
Kurt Cobain.
I don't consider
Prince.
Him androgynous either. I mean, Kurt Cobain was, to me, was completely, was all male. I thought that he was pretty sexy. To me, Beck is his emo. There's a difference to emo and androgynous, to me. Androgynous has a sexiness to it, whereas emo is just sort of weak. Maybe
well,
this is me.
Yeah, I mean, I think androgynous to most people means you can't tell whether it's a woman or a man, which is the classic definition, of course. She also highlights Jagger and Joplin, well, Mick Jagger and Janis Joplin, as being in that vein, pansexual.
Again, I would disagree with both of them.
Well, she concludes her piece by writing, "Rolling Stone's own history reflects the rock scene's often muddled relationship with sexual liberation. It's into this fraught arena that Adam Lambert steps. By clearing up a few things, he's making progress, not just for himself." And that's, I guess, what I was talking about. You know, he's coming out and talking about his own sexuality. My question would be, why does he even have to? Who really cares? When Ellen DeGeneres did this on her television show, it was a big deal. Everybody cared that there was an openly gay female actress in a mainstream television show. And she became the spokeswoman for gay America. Is Adam Lambert now the spokesperson for gay people around the world, or at least gay people in the United States?
Well, he said that he doesn't want to be, and I don't really blame him. I think he just wants to be a performer. And I think it comes back to, you know, maybe I'm biased because of my girl crush on him, but he does exude a certain sexuality, and I think it's that people are interested in. The fact that he happens to be gay makes it more newsworthy, I suppose. You know, if he wasn't gay and just said, you know, I don't know, I'm heterosexual, nobody would care. But he still would have made it onto the cover of Rolling Stone. It's his sexuality and talent. It's the fact that both men and women can have a crush on him. It opens up his audience that much bigger.
Well, he says here, he doesn't write, but he was quoted in Rolling Stone as saying, "I was worried that coming out would be so sensationalized that it would overshadow what I was there to do, which was sing. I'm an entertainer, and who I am and what I do in my personal life is a separate thing. It shouldn't matter. Except it does. It's so confusing."
Isn't that interesting? Those last two sentences are fascinating to me. The last three, "it shouldn't matter, except it does." And he doesn't explain that.
He doesn't, and he does go on to say that he doesn't want to be a civil rights activist. So
yeah. He shouldn't have to be. Just because he's famous and he's gay doesn't mean that he needs to be the spokesperson for you know, all gay and lesbians. Just when he says it shouldn't matter except it does, it's who is he talking about? That's what I think is interesting.
Well, he signed a deal this week with 19 Entertainment and RCA Recordings, so he'll put out an album. And
well,
maybe he'll be a spokesperson.
I think they all signed with 19 Entertainment. That's not a huge surprise.
Right. Precisely. That's the American Idol label.
Yeah.
And his record is expected this fall. So line up now.
Well, I'm wondering if he's going to write his own stuff or if it's going to be covers. Or I think he's going to write his own stuff. I don't know.
I've never heard this guy sing. I've only seen pictures
of him.
Oh, he's so
good. He's so good. He's what got me into American Idol. I didn't watch American Idol. I happened to catch that one where he sang Mad World for the very first time because my sister watched this show. And I was hooked. After that, I was just like, okay, this guy's going to win American Idol. Of course, I was wrong. But, you know, one thing that I have a feeling I'm not going to be wrong about is we keep talking about Conan and Jay Leno, and you know that I believe that Leno is not going to do well in the ratings. I don't think that means they're going to take him off the air because I think he's going to be really cheap, and also they can't, you know, make him mad by doing that. But I just want to point out that more and more people are agreeing with me. The advertising age is saying that NBC is touting Jay Leno's new primetime program as an innovative DVR-proof move. Buyers say the new talk show will draw fewer viewers than ABC and CBS on any given night and are balking at paying primetime prices.
Well, I think this week the love affair with Conan O'Brien was over because, if I'm not mistaken, David Letterman on CBS on The Late Show,
Oh,
the
yeah,
ratings were
he did
better
much
for that
better too.
program than for Conan's program, The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and there's that. Conan's ratings aren't doing so great. But, you know, I think you have to take a lot of this from just take a look at the grand scheme. You'd have to check and see how Jay did when he started. And I'm sure, of course, the ratings spike when they first start. People want to see what they're like, and then the ratings go down because ratings go down. I mean, people, the interest isn't there anymore. I'm sure it was the same with Jay. I don't think we can judge Conan on this. What I think is interesting is that, you know, they're two very different forms of comedy. So I'm wondering if that's going to work in the late night slot. But I expect people will get used to them.
Well, as Michael Sipley will have you believe, everybody's a critic. Michael Sipley, of course, yes, that's a horrible segue, but Michael Sipley, whose name I'm hoping I'm pronouncing correctly because I've been reading him for well over a decade. He, of course, is the writer now. He covers Hollywood for the New York Times, and he used to do the same thing for the Wall Street Journal, Talk Magazine. He's been a producer for Sony. So he's a well-respected journalist. He's written a couple of interesting articles recently, and we were hoping to have him on this episode to talk about them. He sends his regrets and hopes to be on next week or in the near future. But we'll give you a little homework assignment this week to go out and read on NewYorkTimes.com. We'll also put links to these stories in the show notes. But search for Michael Sipley, his last name spelled Ciepley. And a story on New Line Cinema, how New Line Cinema is progressing now that they are part of Warner Brothers, as well as an article he wrote on Ari Emanuel, who we've mentioned several times on this show as being the head of Endeavor and now the new head of William Morris Endeavor Entertainment,
WME.
WME. He did
Or
a
WME2.
yes. He did a very interesting profile on that. These are two great stories and well worth discussing, and we hope to be doing so with Michael in the not too distant future. But he also wrote this week, I mean, it's been a great week for him. He's had some really great stories. A story headlined, "Everybody's a Movie Critic, New Websites and Online Readers Chime In." And he writes, "They have suffered pay cuts, layoffs, and Hollywood's urge to write them off every time a poorly reviewed movie makes good at the box office. But America's film critics, an ornery lot, are not dead yet. In fact, their craft has shown flickering signs of new life lately, though not the kind that leaves ink-stained cinephiles entirely comfortable." And he goes on to talk about MovieReviewIntelligence.com, a new website committed to monitoring, scoring, and proliferating the work of critics at some 65 print and broadcast outlets. It was started by David A. Gross, a former marketing executive with 20th Century Fox, and the new site is replete with charts, graphs, and information that tracks the good, the bad, and the ugly of movie reviews.
Pictures? Pictures? Charts and graphs?
I don't understand why anybody cares about this. This is not a Me Too company. This is like a Me Nine company. I mean,
Yeah,
everybody's
I
doing
don't
this.
understand why anybody cares about this either. Really don't. I'm looking at it right now. I'm like, yeah, okay, so what? I mean, my mother is certainly not going to go on this site and be like, oh, well, The Hangover has gotten 70% positive reviews. I'm going to go see that. No, my mom's going to say, The Hangover? That sounds like a terrible movie about drunk people. I'm not going to go see that.
You know, I actually, if I'm on the fence about a movie, I'll go to Rotten Tomatoes and I'll say, okay, well, what are the critics that I know? I mean, that I either read or I know personally, and I know what their taste is. What do they say about a movie? Now, not everybody has the luxury of knowing some of these critics on a one-to-one basis, but you do know them from the movies they've said they've enjoyed previously.
Oh yeah, no, my boy is Owen Lieberman in Entertainment Weekly.
He's
I
actually
agree with
quoted in
him.
the story.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with him. I would say 95% of that. But sometimes he doesn't review the movies that I want to see. Sometimes Lisa Schwartzbaum at Entertainment Weekly reviews them. And I hardly ever agree with her, but it's always kind of 50-50. Like, I can't go like, oh, she liked it, I'll hate it, because sometimes I agree with her. That's it. Go on. My rant is over.
Rant over. That was a short one.
Yeah, it was. So here's what's really kind of frustrating is that I've got this really kind of, coolly laid out website, and it's got all these movies on it, but I can't click on the movie to find out what it's about.
It's not really well designed, that's for sure.
I mean, well, actually, it looks like it wants to do something here. No, it doesn't want to do anything. It looks like it does.
Their
Damn.
tagline
Firefox.
says, "Giving moviegoers the most accurate and complete picture of movie reviews possible, a professional standard for measuring and understanding reviews." If you have to understand a review, you probably shouldn't be seeing the movie.
Okay, look at this. It's like a PowerPoint presentation with all kinds of bubbles, colored bubbles telling. This is ridiculous.
We'll put a link to the site in the show notes. I mean, watch it become the next biggest site on the internet, and we're all wrong.
No, there's no way. I mean, look at this. Are you looking at these? At this bubble chart?
Oh, wow, look at that. Yes. It's very interesting the way he.
I can't even figure out what this is trying to tell me.
You know what I need? Forget about a summary of how to understand the movie review. I need a summary of how to understand this chart.
I need a cheat sheet for the website.
That's amazing.
Okay, we've given these people enough free publicity. Let's move on.
Oh, actually, I see how he's doing it. He breaks it down to national press, local newspapers, alternative indie newspapers, highbrow press, movie industry press. So that's what? Variety and the Hollywood Reporter? New York, LA, Chicago, and Toronto newspapers. And then.
Okay, this seems like an awful lot of work.
I agree with you. I don't know. Who has time for this?
Who has time for this? Exactly. He must be unemployed. Does he work at Bweep?
Well, maybe.
Do I know this
Well, your boy
No
Owen
comment.
Gleiberman here told Michael Seipel these sites. Okay, your boy Owen Gleiberman here tells Michael Seipel of the New York Times, quote, "These sites serve a clear and valuable purpose."
And what is that clear and valuable purpose? Usually, I just want to know where a movie I am want to see is playing and when.
Well, in all fairness to Mr. Gleiberman, Michael Seipel goes on to write, "Mr. Gleiberman and other critics acknowledge that the aggregators, including broad gauge sites like Yahoo Movies, which also compiles critical scores, are bringing new and younger readers to their work."
Okay. But how many of these people really care about reviews?
I think
What do
what
I,
A.O.
right?
Scott, the co-chief movie critic for the New York Times, says in the piece is very accurate. He points out that many new readers are also citizen writers who flood the digital universe with their own thoughts about films and about the critics who are paid to judge them. Quote, "So the paradox is that the web has invigorated criticism as an activity while undermining it as a profession." Which I agree with. Now
I
everybody's
totally
a
agree with,
critic.
which is why to me Rotten Tomatoes makes much more sense because it allows, normal people like you and I to put in our 2 cents too.
But when I say something like G.I. Joe does not look like a good movie, or G.I. Joe isn't a good movie if I've seen it, or The Hangover is very funny, I'm not saying it as a movie critic, I'm saying it as a moviegoer.
I guess really what I want in a movie critic is somebody who's, like you said, someone whose taste I understand. So he or she can watch the movie and tell me whether I would like it. That's really all I want. When they start getting into things in terms of like structure and stuff like that, like let's save that for the what was it? The highbrow magazines or whatever. Let's save that for that. 'Cause when they get into that, I don't really care.
It'll be interesting to talk to Michael and find out his own viewpoints on this and what he thinks of effectively reviews being reviewed.
Yeah.
It will be interesting to actually ask Michael Seipel what he thinks about reviews being reviewed when we get a chance to speak with him. And remember, your homework for next week or whenever we have Michael on will be to read the New Line story he wrote for the New York Times as well as the story on Ari Emanuel. Now, should we go to the email?
Oh, yeah.
We promised you we would be reading some of the emails that listeners send in, and we have one here from Rochelle. She writes, "Hey guys, I love your podcast, but I am never able to listen to the whole thing. I usually listen during my break at work, but I only get 30 minutes. Is there any way you could shorten your podcast so people don't miss the tail end? Thanks, Rochelle." Now, my first thought was, who are you working for? Who's your boss? Can we call them and maybe
get
you
30
a longer...
minutes for lunch?
30 minutes? Isn't that a lunch hour? You're getting a lunch half hour.
Exactly.
So the first problem here is not that our podcasts are too long, but that your lunch is too short.
I think it's too short.
But I will admit, as the person who edits these things, they're way longer when we record them. So
they are. We've already gone over tonight. It's over already.
That is correct. We've gone over tonight, but by the time it's edited, we're surely going to be within an hour. When we have journalists on in a roundtable or panel discussion, like Stephen Garrett or Michael Giltz or Ann Thompson, it runs a little long because we don't want to be rude and cut out stories or rude and.
And I want to pick their brains, so that takes a while too.
Right, but we really are trying to keep this under an hour. One thing to know, though, for Rochelle and other listeners, is that if you're listening through our site, you can actually press play on the little player in each post, but then also skip ahead in the podcast. So if you've already listened to the first 30 minutes, you can just kind of click further into the timeline and skip ahead. You don't have to listen to the whole thing over from the start. Of course, you can download the podcast from iTunes, and then you could really just skip around using your iPod or your favorite MP3 player. So, Rochelle, we are listening. We are trying to make them shorter.
Thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you for listening. I think we've really kind of hit a rhythm here where we kind of know how we're going to cover these stories, especially when we have guests, and that we are going to try and keep it to under 60 minutes.
Yeah.
Our initial hope, though, was to keep it under 30 minutes, and I think we just kind of gave up on that.
Well, because there's always so much to talk about. But now I think we've finished everything that we need to talk about this week.
That's right. We have come to the end of our show. And we should direct you to our website at showbizsandbox.com. And you can find links to all of the stories we talked about tonight in the show notes. And you can also find a way to donate to the podcast so that we can keep it going. You can also
Since I don't have a job.
Especially since you donate to Karen. That's right.
I'm going to put a link up to my personal PayPal account.
That's right. Well, no, the link is to a PayPal account that is for the show. So you'll be donating to the show.
Yes, absolutely. Donating to the show. I promise I'm not going to go into our code and fix that.
Even though she knows how to now, because of course.
Even though I know how to.
Also on our website, you can find the email address to email us. And of course, as you saw, we just read a listener's email, and we will read your email if you email us, more than likely. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. So it's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also send us a voicemail, and we'll go through the voicemails each week, pick a few to play on the show. You can call us at 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. And, of course, links to all of our social networking accounts you can find on our website as well. We have a page on Facebook, a group in LinkedIn. We have a Twitter account, which is...
I'm working on our MySpace.
Karen's working on the MySpace page. Our Twitter account is ShowbizSandbox. And you can send us links using Delicious, the social bookmarking website. If you tag any news story that you think we should be considering for the next episode or for an upcoming show, just tag it ShowbizSandbox, all one word, and it will come to us. We check that on a daily basis. Well, Karen, I'm sorry to hear about your job, but hopefully your unemployment will be short-lived.
Hopefully.
Or our listeners will donate enough money to turn this into your day job.
Please!
Or Virgin America will actually sponsor the
sponsor
show.
Us. Okay, Sperling, I've missed you in L.A.
Well, you'll be missing me for a couple more weeks. I get back July 11th, but we will hopefully continue to do the podcast while I'm on the road. Until next week, play nice.